Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation, which took place as a co-presentation between Sydney Writers Festival and Sydney Festival in January of this year.
G'day everyone, and welcome to the Sydney Writers Festival, which is a part of the Sydney Festival. My name is Benjamin Law, and I'm so pleased to be here with you all today on Gadigal land. First Nations people on this continent, like the Gadigal of the Great Eora Nation, have been sharing stories and knowledge here for tens of thousands of years. Combined, they constitute the oldest continuing civilization this planet has ever seen, and we are particularly grateful to elders past and present that we get to continue sharing knowledge here on what is and what will always be Aboriginal land. Now, this conversation today is part of Something to Talk About, a series of entertaining, hopefully, conversations from some of the world's best writers. And in addition to this morning's conversation here, there are two more events in the series also taking place at Carriage Works over the weekend, so make sure to check them out. But our guest today is the author of the novel Shuggy Bain, a book that first gained momentum as a word-of-mouth favourite during the first phases of lockdown. And now, of course, it's the winner of the Booker Prize. Set in a recession-hit Scotland, Shuggy Bain is an unforgettable story about class, addiction, and the love between a child and his mother. And its Scottish-American author spent 10 years writing this story, his first novel, which is scheduled to be now translated into 22 languages and published around the world. Douglas Stewart, welcome to the Sydney Writers Festival.
Thank you for having me, Benjamin. I'm so glad to be here.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. Now, tell us, where are you in the world right now, and how's it feeling where you are?
I am actually about 100 miles north of New York City in the Catskill Mountains. It feels like it's below zero physically, and it is. And it's just been the most wonderful but also surreal year. All these incredible things keep happening for Shuggy, and the book to me feels a little bit like a part of myself. It feels like a little boy, actually, because of the character at the heart of it. And so it's been strange to send him out into the world and not be able to follow him and look after him.
Mm. It must be surreal not only publishing a book, but also having the incredible year with the book that you've had, but probably not changing locations that much.
That's right. And actually, it's been my entire experience of publishing, because I published about 2 weeks before the pandemic hit here in New York. And so my entire life, or my entire experience of what it's like to have a book, is about sitting on this sofa that I'm so sick of now.
That's where you live now. You're not going to move from that sofa for the rest of your life. Let's talk about the incredible novel that you've written. So Shuggy Bain, this story is fictional, but I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that you can probably identify with the main character. You've said before that you grew up as a queer son of a single mother, and all of my earliest memories have drink involved in them. Look, as you were growing up, did you have the vocabulary for understanding and processing what you were experiencing at the time?
That's a great question. And no, I don't think I did. And the wonderful thing about children is they face whatever is in front of them, and because they have no context of it being any different, they do it unquestioningly, and they have such resilience and hope and power and love. And that's not just me, that's all children I observe. And that was really what I wanted to do with Shuggy Bain, was just to show this love story between a mother and son, but it's a very specific type of love. It's a often tested, unconditional, hopeful love that sort of is very embattled, but gets up every single day and tries again.
Mm. So the core relationship here is between a child and his mother. And the mother in this story is Agnes, who is a woman who's utterly beautiful, Elizabeth Taylor level kind of beauty, but so vulnerable and unlucky in so many ways. You're going to read us a bit from your book about Agnes soon, but tell us about who she is.
Yeah, Agnes is inspired a little bit by my own mother, but by many women in Glasgow that I knew She is not only beautiful, she's also brilliant and funny and determined and driven and calamitous and sometimes her own worst enemy. She's lots of very complicated things. And sometimes we talk about the character as being the alcoholic mother. And for me, Agnes is a wife and a lover and a friend and a foe and a mother and lots of great things before actually her addiction comes into play. And that's really just a condition she's living with. That's not her personality. But Agnes is a woman who, for the first half of the book, is seen as being almost too much. She wants too much. But the things Agnes wants are actually incredibly realistic. She wants a house with its own front door, a council house, not even her own home, but something from the government with its, her own front door because she lives with her mother and father in a high-rise flat. She wants a rose garden. She wants a caravan by the sea to be adored, a little bit of glamour. And she's seen as being too much, but actually, in truth, it's the world around her that's not enough or that won't rise up to meet these small wants.
And tell us about the reading that you're going to that you're about to read. Give us some context about how we're about to meet Agnes.
Yeah, this is when we first meet Agnes in the book. It's from the very beginning of the book. But Agnes is married. She is actually a Catholic mother, and she's married across sectarian lines, where she has married a Protestant taxi driver called Big Shug. But she is having a Friday night card party with some of her friends in the infamous Sighthow Tower block that has since been torn down. And she's sort of looking around and casting her eye around and chafing at the smallness of her life. She's a woman that had so much potential and is so adored both by her mother and father and by her friends. And I think she's starting to sort of look around and be like, how did I get here? How did this happen? But this is Agnes at the card party. The women cackled without breaking their concentration on the cards. It was sweaty and close in the front room. Agnes watched her mammy, little Lizzie, carefully studying her hand, flanked by the bulk of Nan Flanagan on one side and Renee Sweeney on the other. The women sat thigh to thigh and tore at the last scraps of a fish supper. They were moving coins and folding cards with greasy fingers. Anne-Marie Easton, the youngest amongst them, was concentrating on rolling mean-looking cigarettes of loose tobacco on her skirt. The women spilt their housekeeping money on the low tea table and were pushing 5 and 10 pence bets back and forth. It bored Agnes. There was a time before baggy cardigans and skinny husbands that she had led them all up to the dancing. As girls, they had clung to one another like a string of pearls and sang at the top of their voices all the way down Sucky Hall Street. They had been underage, but Agnes, sure of herself even at 15, knew she would get them in. The doorman always saw her gleaming at the back of the line and beckoned her forward, and she pulled the other girls behind her like a chain gang. They held on to the belt of her coat and muttered protest, but Agnes just smiled her best smile for the doorman, the smile she kept for men, the same one she hid from her mother. She had loved to show off her smile back then. She got her teeth from her daddy's side, and the Campbell teeth had always been weak. They were a reason for humility in an otherwise handsome face. Her own adult teeth had come in small and crooked, and even when they were new, they had never been white because of the smoking and all of her mammy's strong tea. At 15, she had begged Lizzie to let her have them all taken out. The discomfort of the false teeth was nothing when compared to the movie star smile she thought they must give her. Each new tooth was broad and even and as straight as Elizabeth Taylor's. Agnes sucked at her porcelain. Now here they were, every Friday night, these very same women playing cards in her mammy's front room. There was not a single drop of makeup between them. Nobody had much of a heart to sing anymore. Thank you.
Douglas Stewart, everyone. Thank you so much. She really is, I think, one of the most memorable mothers in literature and one of the most memorable mothers that I've read about recently. One of the things that we often ask ourselves when we're writing stories as novelists or playwrights or screenwriters, a common question that editors will ask of us or that we ask of ourselves is, you know, what's perception versus reality? And for someone like Agnes, what does the world and her community think of her and what's the reality?
Well, that's actually one of Agnes's great flaws or one of her great strengths, depending on how you look at it. Agnes, first of all, would have a regional accent being in Glasgow in the 80s. And so it would be a thick, glottal Glaswegian accent. But she trains herself to speak almost newscaster English or standard English. And she infects her children with that as well. She makes she enforces that Shuggy rounds out his vowels and speaks in an accent that isn't regional. Agnes spends a lot of time with the sort of the veneer of pride. That's one of her key characteristics. But it's about self-worth, and it's about rejecting shame. I think sometimes when characters are in poverty, or when I grew up, you know, in a welfare state, our appearance and how we sort of portrayed ourselves to the world was sometimes the only thing we had control over, and we took enormous pride in it. And so Agnes does that, but what happens to Agnes in the book? You know, she never goes over the front door without making sure she is sparkling clean. She's immaculate. She has a face of makeup. She has her hair done and all of her best clothes, but that often makes her very overdressed or inappropriately dressed for the thing that she's going to do. And even though she is living in this time of 26% unemployment in Glasgow, where a lot of people are going through the same thing, her sort of believing herself to be better or affecting these airs and graces make her feel very isolated.
I mean, when you talk about those rates of unemployment where these characters are, you know, this is a story very much of a time and place. You know, I imagine growing up you experienced the effects of that, but now as an adult writer, going back to capture what it was like and the real economic reality, what kind of work was invested into doing that?
Well, first of all, there was a life lived amongst it. And I think that's the first thing. You know, just growing up there, it left such a mark on me and changed everybody in my family. You know, I come from a long line of very proud tradesmen, slaters, grain hodders, shipbuilders. And suddenly, when I was a young boy, no one could find work. And it wasn't that they just couldn't find work in the industry they were in. There was no other industry to turn to. There was a lot, I write about a lot of things in the book that I just understood how they felt and how they tasted and how they made people act. But I didn't necessarily understand the social movement behind them. I think about sectarianism, misogyny, you know, the social movement and unemployment. And so in terms of writing the book, I had to go back and actually look at the broader context and understand why people were doing the things that they did, that I just knew they did, but I didn't know why they did it. And you sometimes when you grow up in that environment, you don't question why people do that or, you know, why sectarian conversation is fine at the table. And it was like almost like casual banter. And only as an adult, when you step away from it, you're like, oh, that's wrong. That's not how everybody is. And so you have to go back and actually look at it.
I'm so taken by your depictions of alcohol dependency in the book as well. And I think maybe in Australia, maybe we share something where overconsumption of alcohol is kind of permeates society and often isn't as questioned as much. I mean, Agnes is this glamorous, charismatic, canny, smart person, but she does have this problem of dependency, and alcoholism becomes this all-consuming force in the story. You really feel the weight of it, and you feel the weight of it for her kids. And I guess that it feels like there's this implied question for Shuggy and his brother Leek, which is, do you stay or do you move on? What questions did you want the readers to ask of themselves as they were reading about their predicament?
You know, I don't know that I had framed any questions in mind, because I'd only set out to write a very intimate story about what it meant to love someone who was suffering with addiction and to love them unconditionally. But unfortunately, you can't set a story in 1980s Glasgow without it pulling in so many more social issues and raising so many questions. But Agnes is enthralled to alcohol. And I wanted to show that also, sometimes in literature, addiction comes about as having a cause and effect, or there's a pivotal moment where someone starts to slide into drink or into dependency. And actually, in hard drinking cultures, and oftentimes with addiction, there isn't that one single moment. It's just a slow ebbing or a slow sort of increasing of that. And, you know, there's a point where a good time stops being a good time and starts to become a bad time. But oftentimes you can't sort of pinpoint that exact moment. It wasn't a Wednesday in October. It can be over a very long, protracted time. But what I wanted to show also with Agnes is that she's not just a one singular woman who is suffering, but there's a community at large that are also going through a lot of things. There's a lot of heavy drinking around her. And I had grown up to know that addiction certainly damages the addict most at the heart of it, but it scorches everyone around them. And so one of the central questions of the book is, of Agnes's three children, how far do they go to save their mother before they have to save themselves?
You know, this story that you've written with Shuggie Bain isn't ostensibly about queer identity per se, but of course Shuggie is marked out as a queer kid and an outsider, especially by the people around him. He loves dancing, he loves playing with dolls, he's got an allergy to football. what did you seek to capture about growing up as an outsider kid in this area and era with Shuggie Bain?
Yeah, it really, Shuggie and Agnes are both othered quite quickly within the community they're in. Agnes for being, thinking herself too grand or too great, or for rejecting shame and sort of having dignity. And Shuggie, because he's very quickly seen as not being like the other kids, and so he's called no right. But I wanted his queerness almost to be a very low-level Q, not a capital Q, because first of all, he's dealing with many things, as some queer kids do. And sometimes in literature, we don't look at the person again with full sort of facets. We just think about their queerness as the central issue. But Shuggie has other really pressing things on his agenda. But also, his queerness isn't really wrapped in, the disdain for him isn't wrapped in religious ideals or the Bible says that. It's just, you're not like a man. You're not like how men are supposed to be. And so the misogyny and the homophobia in the book really channel back up to the narrowness of society, where even men in the book are only allowed to be a very narrow way. They have to be heavy drinking and heavy hitting and hard loving and hard working. And Shuggie is effeminate and sensitive and precocious and fussy and annoying at times. And so they're just like, what is wrong with you? And actually, he believes something's wrong with them. That was the thing about homophobia I wanted to show it. It places the hate within the person who is hated. And Shuggie hates himself, or he doesn't know the part of himself that's broken. He believes it to be broken. And of course, nothing's broken. And so he goes through all of these routines in the book where he tries to walk like a man and talk like a man. And then he goes through these historical premiership football scores and reads them almost like the rosary, committing them to memory. And of course, what a useless thing to know, unless you're going to be in the pub and talking to men about football.
I mean, so, I imagine, like, for a lot of gay and queer men, especially reading this book, they can see themselves in the way that we try to correct ourselves for the rest of the people around us in Shuggie Bain. I mean, you've kind of articulated that process so articulately just now as an adult, but you personally, was that a process for you to work through too?
Absolutely. And, I mean, it was all about concealment as a kid for me. There was no way for me to be queer or effeminate or anything in the society I grew up in. And nobody came to my aid. Everyone thought that was, you know, no one thought it's okay to be yourself. And so all the signals were there, and it was about concealment. And I tried to change everything about how I walked and how I talked. And there was no clues in media or any heroes to look up at the time in the early 70s or 80s. And in fact, many of the gay men that we would see on television in Scotland were the butt of jokes, or we were meant to laugh at them, not necessarily with them. And so everything was about sort of hiding who I truly was. And I wanted to show that sort of pressure on Shuggie. Shuggie has a lot to deal with.
And you can see the consequences in this book in certain moments where if you don't successfully conceal it, or if you're marked as an outsider, that there are actually real ramifications. It struck me that I noted that your Booker Prize win for Shuggie Bain came during Anti-Bullying Week in the UK, and you've talked about what you call the different frequencies to bullying portrayed in the book. And I'm really struck by that phrase, the different frequencies to bullying. Can you expand on that for us?
Yeah, I think everyone's a little bit under siege in the book. Certainly Agnes and Shuggie is. And like I said, there's the very sort of casual, now in 2021, we call it hate talk. In 1982, we talked, that was how people talked to each other. And there was no sort of solace or safe place to be. And it was just very accepting. And I think there was a lot of people who would say things that were religious hate or homophobic hate or misogynistic and weren't necessarily bad people, but just didn't know that that was such a hurtful thing to be or to say. And so there's all those sort of things that really escalate up to physical violence in the book as well. Shuggie is frequently sort of set upon by other boys, but Agnes is also set upon by men. And that's, you know, there's just all those levels to it.
I kind of feel like, because this book starts with Shuggie at kind of an older age, and I'm not sure if others feel this, but you're left wondering, like, I hope this kid is going to be okay, right? Like, is this a character that you've kind of thought about? I mean, he lives on, but do you find yourself worrying about him? Did you find yourself worrying about him in the writing of this book too?
I did, and actually I found I couldn't let go. Part of the reason why it took 10 years to write is I didn't want to say goodbye to either of them. And so I felt very emotional about them. But the book in some ways is about the end of Agnes and the beginning of Shuggie, and that's how they dovetail together in a way. But the reason why we leave Shuggie where he is and why we also start with Shuggie where he is because I wanted the readers to sort of, I love it as a reader when I have a book and I close the final page and the characters belong to me. I don't think about the writer and I want to know where they are they okay? And I wanted people to think about sort of intergenerational poverty and what lay ahead after everything they've learned through Agnes and Shuggie, and also Lizzie, because we look back at Agnes's mother doing the things she had to do to survive. And then sort of, I wanted them to think about what might come next for Shuggie.
Yeah. Douglas, you mentioned that you wrote this book over the course of 10 years, and part of that was because you didn't want to let them go. But I am curious, you know, around that 10-year mark, 10 years before now, when you started writing Shuggie Bain, what was going on in your life that compelled you to start putting pen to paper?
That's a great question. Actually, I was a kid who'd always wanted to be a writer, Benjamin, but growing up in the British social class, it was just seen as something that boys from the south side of Glasgow didn't do. And so I was funneled into textiles, and that was a great, you know, Scotland's a very proud cloth manufacturer, and it gave me a great career. I managed to build it into a great career. But in 2008, I'm at the height of my career in fashion in New York, and I'm desperately unhappy because I wanted to express myself through writing and through reading. I've always been a huge reader. And so I didn't have a conscious thought to sit down and actually begin writing Shuggie, but I had an urge. And so I sat down and allowed it to sort of flow out of me at the beginning. And actually the book came to me. First of all, I wouldn't allow myself to think it was ever going to be a book because I would have been too intimidated. Who am I to write a book, you know, when people go to MFAs and have creative writing circles and you know, 10 years at Cambridge studying Victorian literature. And there's me, a kid from the south side of Glasgow. And so I just wrote what I could, and I wrote chapter 13 first, and then it went to chapter 22 and back to chapter 3. And before I know it, I had 900 pages of a single space manuscript, which would be a 1,600-page book. But I just loved the creation of the world and spending time with the characters.
Wow, so out there somewhere is the director's cut of Shuggie Bain, uncensored, unfiltered, every DVD extra ready to go. So what happens through there? Because I've read that this book got a lot of rejection. What kind of level of rejection are we talking about?
Yeah, so about 10 years after writing the book, I thought I had to release it, actually, because I felt like I couldn't move on as a writer and as a creative person unless I sent Shuggie out into the world. And so I went down the arduous path of finding an agent, that any debut novelist does. And then my agent began to send the book out for submission. And very quickly, it got some rejections. And rejection's an important part of being a writer, Benjamin. You'll know this. And so you have to learn how to take it and how to toughen up. And it's just part of life. And actually, even after winning the Booker, Shuggie's still being rejected by international publishers. That's just how it is. But there were people who rejected the book very quickly in America, who just, it wasn't for them. And that's the subjectivity of art. I respect that deeply. But then there were people who would write letters, editors that would write letters that say, this is going to win all the prizes, but I don't know how to market it. I don't know, you know, how to tell Americans about this family in Scotland. And I think when we reduce it to geography, and everybody does this in life, we're always sort of trying to label something or put it in a place. But really, the book is about love and hope and resilience and, you know, so many other things. It's not about just about this family in Glasgow in this time. And that's been the surprise of Shuggie, I think, for the publishing industry.
I mean, to take a step back, you've definitely got your own story to tell, things that Shuggie experienced. You can definitely relate to through your childhood. Why was it important for you to write a novel, to write a work of fiction? I imagine other people in your circumstance might be tempted to write a memoir.
I think there's a psychological thing, first of all. First of all, men from the west coast of Scotland are never allowed to think of themselves as being exceptional, not exceptionally great or exceptionally hard done to. And So you kind of grow up with feeling like your own story might not be worth very much. But then also growing up as a kid that went through hardship and went through trauma, you have no control over that. You're just, that's where you are and that's the circumstances in front of you. And when you sit down to write fiction, you get to, and especially when you lose a parent through addiction, because that feels like such an enormous failing to you, even as the kid, at a very early age. And so when you sit down to write fiction, you have ultimate control. You know, it is a work of fiction, Benjamin. I never knew my own father, so the whole character of Shug is from my imagination, and I can give you lots of examples of that. But when you write fiction, you take control, and that was a great place to be. It was an incredibly cathartic and healing place to be, but it was something that I needed, I think.
Look, you're talking to someone who wrote a memoir about his own family because he's a sociopath. you know, for me, that was like this ethical minefield to figure out what was on limits, off limits, at what point I consult my family, all of that sort of stuff. You are writing a work of fiction. At the same time, I imagine people in your life can see echoes of your life in there. Was that kind of an ethical map or that you had to navigate as well? Were there conversations with real life people that you needed to broach?
There wasn't so much of that. I did let my family read the book before it was published or before I sent it out, and that was fine. There was nothing to report there. But I understood from the very beginning of writing the book that, first of all, I didn't imagine that one boy would understand everything about this world. And addiction, because it affects so many people and because the social movement in Glasgow encompassed, you know, harmed and hurt so many people, I wanted to show it as multifaceted with as big a chorus of voices as I could. And so almost as soon as I started to write the book, it dwarfs what any one young boy could ever have known. And you'll know from reading the book, it spans the city in a way, but it also goes across about 40 or 50 years of history. And there was no way for me to be able to claim knowledge or you know, personal experience of that. And so it very quickly just really dwarfed my own experience.
Forgive me if this is a bit of a nerdy question about the writing process, but like when you start off with that massive kind of manuscript that you were talking about that was 900 pages plus, what's the process from there? Like, because you're telling such an intimate, personal, tender story, and I imagine that to cut anything about this story and these lives would be quite a difficult both creative process to go through and maybe a painful process generally. How do you go about that? What did you decide didn't necessarily need to be invested in this novel?
I think the one of the strange things about the book is it didn't really change, although it was edited, meaning the characters still have the same motivations and how they come into the world and leave the world was still the same. The beginning, the middle, and the end of the book remained the same. But it distilled an awful lot. And I think I was so enamored by the chorus of Glaswegian characters that I kept wanting to allow them to come up to me and tell me their story. And so Jinty would come and tell me 20 pages of her backstory, and Catherine took me to South Africa and showed me what South Africa was like. And at the end of the day, and it was sort of also supported with my editor by the time it got to that process, the heart of the book is Shuggy and Agnes. And so I knew to winnow back and keep the lens on them because that's where, you know, that was really the heart of it.
And I've also discovered your work originally through your short stories in The New Yorker. There was one that came out just before Shuggy was released called Found Wanting, and I was just like, who is this guy? And I was so pleased to see that you had a novel coming out after that. The Englishman was a story that came out after Shuggy Bane. Where are you? Are you writing these short stories alongside the novel, or have they come later on? Do they exist in the same universe as Shuggy Bane?
They do. I think I'm always writing from a sense of loss and belonging, and for people trying to find their tribe or love is something that really motivates me, especially around masculinity as I sort of progress. I had actually been writing for quite a long time. It's just publishing I haven't been doing very, very long, Benjamin. And so, you know, I have quite a body of work. Actually, my second book is already finished, and we're hoping that it's going to join the world in spring 2022, so a year from now. But you know, I was actually most, the story of Found Wanting, the first story I wrote for The New Yorker, came from a fact that I was talking to a young gay friend who grew up in the time of the internet. And we were just talking about how when I was a kid, I had to write these letters in the back of magazines to just make friends and find my tribe. And he was stunned. And I thought,
you're basically a dinosaur.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm only in my 40s, but that was like, he just couldn't believe it. And so that's where that story sort of stemmed from.
I do love when you kind of reach a certain stage and age of being a gay man, where of course we've got our elders, but we've got people significantly younger as well. And because technology changes so fast, you may as well be talking about a different reality of how queer people have actually found each other through time. I mean, that's one of the remarkable things, I think, about your story. Hey, look, you mentioned before that you were working as a fashion designer. Are you still working as a fashion designer now?
I am not. I think because writing had been a dream of mine mm-hmm. that I'd furloughed for so long, since I'm about 16 or 17, that when Shuggy was accepted to be published, I actually quit my fashion job or my career in fashion. I put it on hold at first. Because I wanted to be really present for I'd been working so hard for this and for so long that I wanted to be present and in the moment. And I think what the booker did is it said I made the right gamble, but I think, yeah, I'm not going to go back to fashion.
I mean, tell me more about that, because on the page, you've designed for the likes of Calvin Klein and Ralph Lauren, and you were doing that in big cities. It sounds incredibly glamorous. You did mention before that you hit a point where you didn't feel happy with that industry and you wanted to pivot. What was it about fashion designing that you decided, actually, that's enough?
Oh, gosh, I need my therapist for that one. I don't know.
You're in a safe space, Douglas.
That's a big career. You know, the one thing that's very different that writing gives me that fashion has never been able to give me is fashion is a very collaborative, instinctual, fast thing, but it also doesn't cherish its children. You're always creating something and then it burns and you're on to the next, and it's this very sort of relentless thing. And for a creative person, that's can be ultimately unfulfilling. Mm. You're leaving nothing behind yourself and nothing matters but the next thing you're about to do. And when I was actually working in fashion, you know, I work very long days. I would work 12, 14-hour days. New York's a very restless city. Fashion's a very competitive industry. And so I would have to write in the morning before I went to work, or I ruined all my family holidays, every single one for about 10 years, because all I wanted to do was write. And my husband, you know, had to support that, or he was so great to support that. But writing for me, I was incredibly protective of it because I was finally creating something just for myself, first of all, but also something that that lasts, that endures, that is introspective, that you can question and really sort of think about, as opposed to this very instinctual, fast-paced thing that I was doing during the day.
I mean, the reason I'm interested in that is I'm sure that there are a lot of people out there who would really love to commit themselves to writing or have been committing themselves to writing in a serious way outside of their main vocation or day job or core commitments. You know, like if you could give those people advice, or if you could even go back in time and talk to that version of yourself in order to prep them to treat writing as their main calling, what advice would you give?
You know, I don't know that I have the greatest advice, but all I will say that worked for me is to place actually no pressure on the final outcome. I think we're so focused in every facet of society that we have to create something and the end thing is the thing. First of all, just sit down and enjoy your writing and enjoy what you're doing and trust in the power of accumulation in that way. That's really how I sort of got to Shuggy at the end. I didn't want to think of it as a finished thing. And I think if you do that, then you'll sit in front of a blank page at the beginning and you'll really intimidate yourself. Instead, write what you feel and write what you know and what you want to express. And it will come. It really, really will come. And I think that's what worked for me.
Is there anything about your previous life as a fashion designer that has helped you as a writer? Because sometimes when I talk to writers and they've had previous experiences as like a veterinary nurse, or they've worked as a geologist, and the way in which their previous life has actually informed their work has been quite unexpected and strange and surreal. Is there any relationship between the two for you? They're both creative processes, I imagine.
Yeah, I think so. It's hard for me to analyze because I'm so close to it, and it's almost for other people to tell me what it looks like and feels like. But, you know, when I sat down to begin writing, I felt incredibly inadequate. You know, I was a kid that grew up in a house with no books, Benjamin, and I came to books really late in life as a young adult, and so I just felt that sort of weight and that unworthiness. But I've always been creating worlds visually. I've always been talking about texture and color and pulling in all these different references and hopefully transporting people through my visual work, you know, or making them feel something or realize something. And so about 6 months into writing what became Shaggy Bane, I stopped trying to be my idea of what a writer does. And instead, I relied on my visual language and my visual training, my world creation abilities. And it actually helped me in a lot of ways because I realized halfway through it that if anyone reads this book, then I really want them to be in the room with Shuggy and Agnes. I don't want to be the author standing between them and sort of relaying everything to them. I wanted it to really be an experience where they felt immersed in the world. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think my visual skills helped me with that.
You just mentioned something that's really hit me, which is you grew up without many books or without any books around you, and books came to you later in life. And it makes me wonder, I mean, first of all, what was the absence of books mainly the cost and lack of access to libraries and things like that?
Yeah, I think it was just there was no interest in my family in books. And I placed no value judgment on that because I think ultimately it only strikes people as strange because of the literary world I'm now in. But as a kid, I had no books at home and neither did any of my friends. And it didn't stop us being creative or inquisitive children or using our imaginations in other ways. You know, I sometimes joke that we did actually have four shelves of books, but they were all those vinyl VHS covers. And so you would reach for a Henry James and you would get four episodes of Dallas. And that was pretty much it. But there's no judgment. That was just who we were. We're, you know, our fathers were hardworking men and we just didn't have books at home. And actually, in my own particular sort of life, I discovered that you need an enormous amount of peace within yourself as a child and also in your environment to be able to read. And until actually I become 16 and the bullying falls away and I start to become more independent, and actually after the death of my mother, I didn't have that. I couldn't have sat down and concentrated on a book because there was just too much going on.
So when you start getting access to books and you start getting interested in reading, I mean, how does that come about and what were the books that really blew your mind?
Actually, one of the sad facts of that is the high school I started probably had about 320 kids that came in first year. And then by the time we get to fifth and sixth year, there's only 12 of us.
Wow.
Because they're very pressing things to attend to in real life. Again, there's no judgment on that. Mm. It's a lot sometimes to ask a kid in poverty to focus on another 2 or 4 years of education when you could really use a couple of pounds that week and get a job or an apprenticeship. And so school just stops being a riot, to be totally honest. And, you know, it stops being about crowd control and meeting the needs of kids that might not be having their needs met at home. And the teacher can really just focus on me. And so, you know, that's when my world opens up and I'm introduced to Thomas Hardy and John Donne and even Tennessee Williams. Playwrights are a huge influence on me because I'm always thinking about dialogue and dialect. But that's really when it happened. But it came too late for me as a kid because by then, you know, I was so far behind academically. And so I'm sent instead to learn how to, you know, to weave and knit because then I can always have a job.
So it's one thing to read as a reader. It's another thing to read like a writer. And by the time you start writing Shuggy Bane, are there books in mind where you're like, it would be great if I could make Shuggy Bane a book like blah, blah, blah. Mm. Not exactly like, but, you know, if I could convey what those books conveyed to me as a reader, I'll have done well. Were there any books you had in mind for that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Growing up and reading and even the things that you're given to in school were always sort of classics or white middle-class English voices. And so in my 20s, I start to discover both queer literature and also Scottish literature. I'd never actually read Scottish books until I hit my 20s, and which is strange because I was a boy that had never left Scotland. And so that was just about representation, I think. But, you know, Shuggy, in a way, stands at the foothills of some giants. When I think about James Kelman or Alistair Gray or Irvine Welsh, who also deal with, like, the post-industrial landscape and addiction in many cases. But I was aware that they always center a man at the heart of the story and a heterosexual man. And for me, Glasgow is a man's city. You can't say it's not. But for me, my Glasgow was always about women because I was the son of a single mother. Mm. And my mother's friends were all women and my aunts. And as a young boy, men would have nothing to do with me. There was no place in society for me. And so all my friends were girls. And so I actually knew Glasgow as a woman's city and for the strength of the city to be women. And so when I'm sitting down and I'm writing this book, there are precedents for it. But I wanted really to focus on sort of a queer boy and a mother at the heart of it.
Mm. This past year has been such a ride for you and the novel that you've put out in the world. But let's go back a year. Let's rewind when the book's first coming out and everyone's going into lockdown. But your book's finally out, and I'm sure it must be gratifying to get responses from readers. What were people telling you after they had read your novel?
You know, it was such a wonderful moment because it had been such an accumulation of work in 12 years and then it happened. But what I didn't actually get the chance of is because the book published and then 2 weeks later, everything closed down. I didn't get to connect with readers. It just didn't happen. And so I didn't get that much feedback at the very beginning. And also you start to level set your success. And as a debut novelist, it's important that people can see your book or discover who you are and everyone was focused on different things at the time. And so I started to grieve Shuggy a little bit, actually, because it was a very modest success. In fact, it wasn't a success at all. Let me not mislead you. It was looking like he might vanish. And it was only really in the mid part of the year when he starts to make the National Book Award list and the Kirkus and the Booker that people start to come to the book again. And then it starts to have a second life in a way, or its life.
Oh my God, thank God. I feel so relieved. I mean, I know how the story ends, but like just that moment where you're just like, because so many books over the past year, especially by debut novelists, have disappeared without that kind of infrastructure of touring and publicity and festivals. So I'm so glad that Shuggy made it out alive. You know, when I released my memoir, I worried that no one would be interested in it because, you know, it's about a little Asian gay kid growing up in regional Queensland as his parents fall apart during the height of Pauline Hanson. It's a classic Australian story. But for you with Shuggy Bain, you know, this is such a specific story set in such a specific place about a very specific dynamic that I don't feel has been told before, and definitely not told in this way. And I know a lot of people who have read the book, I know a lot of people that I've shared your novel with, have had incredibly personal responses because of what you depict resonates with their own life. What kind of personal kind of stories have people brought to you? What personal resonances have come up for readers?
Yeah, that's a very bittersweet thing because I think, first of all, so many more people live a life like Shuggy and Agnes than we perhaps see in a society. Mm. And it's a very universal thing from Detroit and Iowa and Philly to outside of Paris and Australia and New Zealand. You know, I'm constantly reminded of how much the book has touched people. And that's a wonderful thing. But people also tell me that they have struggled with their parents and with addiction, or they were sort of excluded from society because they were queer or didn't know how to sort of, they just weren't accepted. And that's always a very sad thing to hear because obviously that's painful, but it's been a wonderful way to connect with people. And I think at the heart of the book is love and hope and resilience and people, Shuggy triumphs in a way. It's a very quiet triumph, but he does triumph. And I think people can relate to that.
Mm. While we're talking about triumph, let's talk about yours, because the Booker Prize is a pretty big deal, and you won this, and I imagine, like, for a first-time novelist, getting on the long list, getting on the short list, and then finally winning, you can't script a better dream run than that. When did you start getting the sense that something like this could actually be a reality?
I didn't get a sense of it until about 4 weeks after it happened. and that's not like false modesty. First of all, everything that's happening to me right now is happening through this tiny camera at the top. And so it feels very surreal.
It's just a doll's house, yeah.
It's just a doll's house. I mean, it's the Truman Show. Someone could tell me. It would be an elaborate social hoax. But to be honest, Shuggie was nominated for some really large American awards as well. Mm-hmm. And I'd gone through the previous weeks not winning those awards, but it was lovely to be nominated but not winning them. And so when I came to the Booker, I spent the month or two before reading the long list and the short list because it was the greatest moment in my career and I wanted to be present. And I knew I wouldn't be able to be present, meaning amongst my fellow finalists. And but when I show up on Booker Day, I've already lost a few times that week alone. And then I was so focused on their work, which is extraordinary. Please read all of the novelists that are on the final list. But I was thinking about them. And when they announced Shuggie, I was honestly stunned, honestly.
So you thought you were going to be the Glenn Close of the Bookers, but you became the Olivia Colman, which is amazing. Sorry, that's a very specific reference, isn't
it? That's the best thing anyone's ever said to me, Ben.
How do the awards actually take place now? Because, I mean, across the US, where you currently are, across the UK, these are two places that have been particularly ravaged and hit hard and continue to be hit hard by COVID-19. Practically, how does it take place? Are you sitting on the sofa you are now when you discovered that you'd won the Booker Prize?
I was, yes. And and afterwards, they whisk you very quickly into a press junket. And so I haven't, we didn't celebrate until maybe midnight that night. And even then, my husband and I are very tired. And it's just a dance around the kitchen. and it's surreal. But, you know, I actually, this is the strangest thing is, I haven't had a chance to personally interact with readers in the flesh, but I've also not seen Shuggie in a British bookstore.
Wow,
I've not
no way.
Seen my family or seen my friends. Yeah, that's the strangeness of 2020.
Yeah. What else have been the most surreal moments in the process? I imagine it's surreal doing all of this from your living room generally, but for a first-time novelist to win the Booker Prize is fantastic. How have things changed and what's been delightful and strange in the process?
I think it's any writer wants to connect with readers and wants people to be able to read their work. And the Booker's been transformative in that way. Like I said, Shuggie was almost sort of disappearing into the void. And then the Booker really changed that. And that's been the most wonderful thing. But there's so much personal history in this book for me. There's a little bit of trauma. There's love. You know, it's not a sad book only. It's also a very joyous and funny book, but there's a lot of me in the book. And so it's been very strange to sort of have a book in the world, but not to feel like you're sharing it with people, but always be at home on the sofa. But it's been wonderful too. I'm looking forward to like actually getting back out into the world like we all are. I know it's slightly different in Australia.
Yes. Look, you correct me if I am wrong, but you are only the second Scot following James Kelman to have won the Booker in its 51-year history. What's been the reactions in the homelands?
Oh, I think it's been really phenomenal. I've been so touched by how Scotland's embraced Shuggie. And one of the biggest compliments is when people say, oh, I know Agnes, or I know Shuggie or Jinty. And that's been phenomenal. It's just been a shame I've missed out and been able to celebrate with them. But when James Kelman won in 1994, I was a young man and trying to find my way in the world. And it was quite an upsetting win for the Booker judges because they saw this really powerful, incredible regional book as almost being outside of the literary establishment. And so it's great to see how much the culture has progressed between James and myself, because I don't think anyone, although it's a working class narrative and there are voices that we don't often hear from, I don't think Shuggie had the same disruption to the literary establishment. And so I think that's a good thing for diversity and a good thing for including more people in the conversation.
Mm. Now, Douglas, congratulations on this. This has been such a fantastic blitz of a run for an amazing novel. You did mention before that you basically, it sounds like you have a vault of work that you're just ready to unleash. And I imagine like other debut novelists who are now feeling the pressure of the second book release really resent you as a result for having all of your work fully prepared. What can you tell us, or what do you feel comfortable telling us about what we can expect next from you?
Well, first of all, those novelists should know that nobody hates me more than I hate myself. So there you go.
That's right. Only I'm some just, consolation for the amazing cash
yeah,
prize.
Yeah, I'm still riddled with anxiety every single day. But I am actually Benjamin, I'm glad that I managed to build a little bit of work, because I think it's hard to top a Booker. And I would be, you know, it has a muting effect as well on a writer, I think, because it's quite intimidating. But when we leave Shuggie at the end of Shuggie Bane, he is on the brink of starting his life. And I wanted to write more about queer loneliness and masculinity. And so my next novel will be this love story between two young men who are desperately in love, but are separated by sectarian gang lines or violence. And so they're fighting almost for opposing housing schemes. But it's really about how it takes an enormous act of bravery to be a gentle soul or a tender soul in a hard place and to be who you are. And one of the young men is sent to the north of Scotland in order to make a man out of him, to man up and really become that person. And it has disastrous consequences for him and for everyone around him. And so I'm excited to share that with you.
Wow, that sounds like a remarkable story. Do you have a title for that novel yet?
I do. It is called Loch Awe.
Loch Awe.
And when Loch Awe. Thank you. You're very good.
when might we expect that?
That should be spring 2022. I think it's either February or May. I'm not sure yet.
And can we expect a short story collection on the way? Because for those of us who have read your short stories, you are incredibly gifted in that particular form of storytelling. Have you got more under your belt?
Thank you. Yes, I do. I'm working on some of them as well. I'm always interested in sort of connections and loneliness and how we reach out and find love. I think I'm always writing about love. So I'm looking to work on that too. But actually what I'm excited to work on at the moment is we're hoping to bring Shuggie Bane and Shuggie and Agnes to the screen. And so I'm actually working on the adaptation with A24 Pictures and hopefully a television series.
Oh, wow. That is so, so exciting, especially for those of us who are familiar with A24's kind of body of work. You know, it sounds like it's in incredibly good hands. And when you talk about working on that, would you be writing the scripts or would you be overseeing who is writing the scripts? What can you tell us there?
Well, right now I'm writing the scripts. And so that's why I spent my Christmas break very busy. But it's a new skill for me. But then I figured I hadn't written a novel until I wrote Shuggie. And so I wanted to sort of plunge into it. And I think also I wanted to dimensionalize the characters and bring some more moments of joy and hope and some more moments, really enrich Leek's story. Ryan, Leek is my favorite character in the book, actually. He is sort of the silent, watchful brother and a very kind man. And I really wanted to enhance his story and give it more dimension.
Douglas, you're not here, but I get the sense that half of the audience, like there were murmurs of excitement when you talked about the TV show, but I sense that there might be some people thinking he won the Booker with his first novel and now he's probably going to write an Emmy award-winning TV series with his first screenplay writing experience, that bastard. Now, Douglas, before we let you go, you know, you mentioned that the Booker shortlist is something that we should all be blitzing through if we have the time and inclination. And it was such a remarkable list as I've been reading through it this year. So that's one good recommendation. We're living in unprecedented and difficult times. It's important that we find comfort in each other, in the arts. What are the things, what have you been watching? What have you been reading? What have you been listening to that has really given you comfort and a sense of solace over the past year?
Oh, that's a great question. I actually really fell in love with old Sophia Loren movies. The '60s. Oh, so incredible. I never actually paid much attention to Sophia before, but what a goddess. And I forget the name of her husband who directed all of the movies, but Yesterday, Today, Tomorrow, and Sorrento Love Affair, I think it's called. But they're phenomenal. And they're also really inspiring because here is this defiant woman at the heart of this working class community. And so she makes me think of Agnes a lot, actually. And then for books, I adored Elaine Feeney's As You Were, which is about three women on an Irish hospital ward. And as a man, it felt like one of those books you read that where you get to see very intimate things and secrets that maybe women don't always tell you. And it's a real gift for that. It's incredible. And then also Gabriel Krauss's Who They Was, about gang culture in South London is just a wild ride. It's like a rocket when you read it. And again, it's a glimpse into a world that most of us probably don't get to go into, and that's a great way to travel. And then the book I read most recently is really bold and really brilliant, and it's called Luckenbooth by a fantastic Scottish writer, Jenny Fagan. And it covers everything. It covers about 100 years in an Edinburgh tenement, and the devil's daughter's in it. There's a seance, there's a drag ball, there's William and Rose. There's everything you could ever want in a book, and it's phenomenal.
That sounds like it's covering all of my interests consolidated into, exactly. into one story. And of course, for those of you who have yet to read Sugi Bain or have people in your life who have yet to read it, please pick up a copy of this book. It will be on sale outside through Glee Books here at the Sydney Writers Festival / Sydney Festival. But in the meantime, Douglas Stewart, congratulations and thank you so much for making the time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe to and rate our channel.